Duke Leto's concubine, Jessica, sat next to the official ambassador from Caladan, as if to reinforce the presence of House Atreides. Shaddam tried to spot empty seats that might indicate absent houses. Applause rippled through the hall, but the reception sounded a bit strained. As Protector of the Imperium and his numerous other titles were called out, Shaddam took time to rehearse again. Finally, he stepped up to the podium. "I am here to inform my subjects of a grave matter." Discreetly, he had ordered that the speaker system be specially amplified only during his speech, so now his words boomed out. "As your emperor, it is my duty and responsibility to enforce the laws of the Imperium with impartiality and firmness." "But without due process of law," shouted one dissenter, a tiny voice in the immensity of the Lansrad Hall. Sardaukar guards, especially the enthusiastic new recruits, were already pushing through the aisles to identify the speaker, who was trying, ineffectually, to melt into the sea of faces. Shaddam frowned, pausing just long enough that the audience noticed him falter. "Not good. As my esteemed ancestor, Crown Prince Raphael Corino, once said, law is the ultimate science. Know this, all of you." He clenched his fist, but, pursuant to Fenring's advice, tried not to look too aggressive, hoping to maintain a fatherly appearance. "I am the law in the Imperium. I approve the codes. I have the right and the responsibility." In the audience, other representatives drew away from the heckler, and the Sardaukar descended on him. Shaddam had given the troops explicit instructions to avoid shedding blood, however, at least during his speech. "Some noble families have been punished because they chose to ignore imperial law. No one here can claim that the guilty parties on Zanavar or Richeese were unaware of their illegal actions." He pounded his fist on the lectern. The microphone carried the vibrations like thunder around the hall. Mutters rippled through the audience, but no one dared to speak out. "If laws are not upheld, if perpetrators suffer no consequences for their crimes, the Imperium will degenerate into anarchy." Self-justification burned in him. Before he could grow angrier, he commanded the holoprojections to begin. "Observe Baikal, all of you." Three-dimensional images filled the governmental chamber, an ominous montage of withering jungles and blighted forests. Unmanned surveillance pods, dropped by the Sardaukar fleet in orbit, had sent image drones flying over the thick jungles to capture the spread of the biological scourge. "As you can see, this scofflaw world is suffering the ravages of a terrible botanical plague. As your emperor, for the protection of all, I dare not allow them to break the quarantine I have imposed." Beautiful green leaves changed to brown and then purplish-black. Animals starved, tree trunks turned gelatinous and toppled. "We must not risk the spread of this blight to other worlds, loyal worlds. Therefore, thinking only of the safety of my subjects, I have placed a cordon around this defiant planet. Even after the plague dies out, the ecosystem of Baikal will take centuries to recover." He made no attempt to sound distraught at the prospect. Since the siege, the Baikali people had instituted frantic measures, burning jungles or spraying corrosive acids in an attempt to isolate the defoliating plague. But nothing worked. It continued to spread, to metastasize across the planet. Smoke curled into the sky. Wildfires raged. Next, he played hollow recordings of the Prime Magistrate pleading for help, delivering speech after speech to the Sardaukar, all falling upon deaf ears. Supreme Bashar Garon allowed no one to escape. After Saddam completed the sickening display, leaving the assemblage in stunned silence, Archduke Armand de Caz requested permission to speak in opposition. Considering the rough treatment the heckler had received, Saddam was surprised to see that the well-liked Archduke had the courage to stand forth. Then the emperor remembered a recent report that House Caz had captured and publicly executed 20 Grumman saboteurs, members of guerrilla teams purportedly sent in to plant fake spice stockpiles to implicate their rivals. Perhaps the loose cannon Viscount Mauritani saw Saddam's preoccupation as an opportunity for him to strike again with impunity. He decided he wanted to hear what the Archduke had to say. "With all due respect, Your Most Imperial Majesty," the tall silver-haired nobleman said in a strong voice from the floor, "I accept your enforcement of imperial laws and the quarantine of Baikal. You are the greatest embodiment of justice in the known universe. You yourself did House Caz a great service, sire, when you defended us against unwarranted Grumman aggression 10 years ago. But I pose this question so that you may have an opportunity to answer directly, so that my esteemed colleagues in this assembly will have no cause to speak in ignorance." Saddam stiffened as the Archduke gestured around the hall. "Because of the horrors inflicted upon us by thinking machines during the Butlerian Jihad, the Great Convention forbids all biological weaponry, just as it restricts the use of atomic weapons. Perhaps you might speak to this fact, Majesty, because some of those here do not understand how it is that you have unleashed such a pestilence upon Baikal without breaking the strictures." Saddam could find no fault with the way the Archduke had phrased his question. In the Imperium, there was a long tradition of polite dissent and discussion among the noble families, including even all-powerful House Corino. "You misunderstand the facts regarding Baikal, Archduke. I released no plague upon Baikal at all. That was not my doing." More muttering, but Saddam pretended not to hear it. "But what is the explanation, sire?" Armand de Caz pressed. "I simply wish to increase my understanding of the law of the Imperium so that I may better serve House Corino." "An admirable goal," Saddam said in a clipped voice, amused at the shrewd phrasing. "After I received disturbing evidence of an illegal spice hoard on Baikal, my Sardaukar fleet approached with the intention of imposing a blockade, until such time as the Prime Magistrate answered the charges against him. However, the panicked Baikali population engaged in an act of piracy, hijacking 2 supply ships that were loaded with contaminated cargo and being sent to a safely isolated biological research station. I had no hand in the theft of those ships. I did not disseminate this scourge. The Baikalis themselves brought about the death of their world." Louder muttering throughout the hall now, with an undertone of uncertainty. "Thank you, sire," Archduke Caz said, and returned to his seat. Later, as he exited the Landsrad Hall of Oratory, Saddam felt exceedingly pleased with himself, and moved with a youthful spring in his step. The conquerors despised the conquered for allowing themselves to be beaten. Emperor Fondil III, the Hunter. Ix, at last. Camouflaged from sensors, the Atreides combat pod looked like just another meteor in its red-hot descent. Piloting the stealth craft, hoping the unresponsive guild would honor the previous agreement to keep their secret, Gurney Halleck set the controls for the polar regions of the machine world. Beside him, Prince Romber sat silently, remembering. Home again, after 21 years. He wished Tessia could be there with him. Before leaving the Highliner, when the two infiltrators had sealed themselves into the small combat pod. The flight auditor, with wide-set eyes, had bidden them farewell. "The Guild is watching you, Rombervenius, but we can offer you no assistance, no overt assistance." Romber had smiled. "I understand. But you can wish us luck." The flight auditor was taken aback. "If such things matter to you, then I will do so." Now, as the pod plunged through the choppy ocean of air, Gurney grumbled that too many Guild members knew their identity and suspected their covert mission. To his knowledge, a Guild pledge of secrecy had never been broken. But they did accept bribes. Prouder and stronger than ever before, Romber said to him, "Think of how interstellar commerce has suffered since House Vernius lost control of Ix. Do you think the Guild would rather keep the Tleilaxu in power here?" Gurney's ink-vine scar turned angry red. With the pod's hull beginning to heat up, he continued the line of descent, gripping the control bar in both hands. "The Spacing Guild is no one's ally." Romber's waxy face showed no flush of emotion. If they started revealing their passengers' secrets, their credibility would crumble. He shook his head. "The Guild will know what we're up to as soon as they start transporting Atreides' forces to Ix anyway." "I know all that, but I can't help worrying. Too many things can go wrong. We've been cut off from Duke Leto, held incommunicado on Junction for a month. We don't know if the plan is still on schedule. We are all running headlong into the dark. The man without concerns is the man without aspirations." Romber held on as the spherical vessel bounced and careened. "Leto will do as he promised. And so will we." They landed hard in an isolated wilderness in the northern latitudes of Ix. The pod came to a rest nestled in folds of snow, surrounded by ice and barren rock, undetected. The secret tunnel there had been intended for Vernius family members trying to escape a subterranean disaster. Now, though, it was Romber's best opportunity to break back into the world that had been taken from him. Working together in the cold night, the infiltrators broke down and rearranged the components of their combat pod. Detachable parts of the hull were designed to be reassembled into various forms. Numerous weapons could be removed and distributed to allies. Plasteel honeycombs were filled with packaged foods. Under the starry blackness, the men waited inside a makeshift, thin-walled shelter, while Gurney planned the long, steep trudge downward. He was eager for action. While he enjoyed discussing strategy and playing Baliset back at Castle Caladan, the former smuggler was a fighter at heart, and not entirely happy unless he could be doing something in service to his liege, be it Dominic Vernius, Duke Leto, or Prince Romber. "I may be ugly, but at least I'll pass inspection as a human. You..." Gurney shook his head, looking at the prince's cyborg parts. "We'll have to come up with a better story in case questions are asked." "I look enough like a Bi-Ixian." Romber raised his artificial left arm and moved his mechanical fingers. "But I would rather be welcomed as the rightful Earl Vernius." All the time Romber had spent as an exile, and the recent pain he had suffered, had made him a better leader. He empathized with his people rather than taking them for granted. Now he wanted to earn their respect and loyalty, as Duke Leto had done with the people of Caladan. During Romber's upbringing in the Grand Palais, while innocently collecting rocks and tapping his fingers in boredom through class after class, he had blithely expected to be the next head of House Vernius, never dreaming that he would have to fight for the position. He, like his sister, had accepted the role into which he'd been born. But there was so much more to being a leader, and he had suffered much to learn this difficult lesson. First, the murder of his mother, Shando, who he now knew had given birth to another child, Emperor Elrud's bastard son. Then, after so many years of hiding, Dominic Vernius had committed atomic suicide, taking a number of Sardaukar with him. And Kylea, driven to madness and treachery, trying to grasp what she believed to be hers by right. Soon there would be more bloodshed, when he and Gurney triggered a subterranean revolution, and Atreides' forces came in to finish off the invaders. The Ixion people would have to fight again, and many would die. But every drop of blood, Romber vowed, would be well spent, and his beloved world would be free again. The universe is always one step beyond logic. Lady Anirul Corino, Personal Journal. Castle Caladan and the nearby military barracks were abuzz with activity. Atreides' soldiers drilled and packed for the big expedition, eager to depart. They cleaned their weapons and inventoried explosives and siege machines, making ready for an all-out battle. To coordinate such a complex operation, they had prepared for months, and Duke Leto had ordered the House Guard to hold back no effort. He owed that much to Romber, and he would risk whatever was necessary. Romber and Gurney could be dead by now. Leto had heard nothing, no word, no calls for help, no news of success. Or they could already be in the middle of a brewing revolution. After the Highliner mishap, the pair of infiltrators had vanished into resounding silence. There had been no further word from Ix. Even so, we will do our utmost, and hope. But if Romber did not succeed, and Atreides' troops were defeated by the Tleilaxu and the Emperor's Sardaukar, then Leto would suffer enormous repercussions here. Caladan itself might be forfeit. Thufir Hawat was uncharacteristically nervous. Leto, though, was completely committed. In his mind, he had already passed the point of no return. He would take the gamble, throw every effort into this fight, even if it left peaceful Caladan vulnerable for a short while. It was the only way he could restore Romber and restore his own heart of honor. The plans were proceeding like a juggernaut. Amid the thousands of decisions that needed to be made, Leto avoided watching the final steps and went instead to the main docks below the castle. As the noble leader of his great house, he had duties at home, more enjoyable ones, though he wished Jessica could be with him. The large fishing fleet was returning, boats that had been trolling around the reefs during the past 2 weeks of hot weather. Once each year, the fleet came in with their seasonal catch of grund, small bluish silver fish that were captured by the netful. As part of a traditional festival, the delicious grund were washed and salted, then boiled in large batches. The tiny fish were spread out on plank tables, and people feasted on them. The Duke loved the Caladan delicacy as much as the coarsest fisherman did. Romber had even more of a taste for grund than Leto did, and this was the first such celebration the Ixion prince had missed in years. Leto tried to drive away his sense of foreboding. The waiting had ground down his patience. Away from the bustling preparations for war, he stood at the end of a dock, watching the first trawlers approach. Already crowds had gathered on the shingle beach, while merchants and chefs hurried to set up tables, cauldrons, and stalls in the old village plaza. Leto heard minstrels playing along the shore. The music made him smile and reminded him of how often Romber and Gurney had practiced their balisets side by side, trying to outdo one another with outrageous lyrics and satirical songs. But even though the Duke tried to enjoy a moment of peace, Duncan Idaho and Thufir Hawat spotted him and approached through the dense, noisy crowd. You should have personal guards with you at all times, my Duke, the Mentat warned. You need to answer questions and make decisions about weaponry, Duncan added. The fleet is scheduled to depart very soon. As Swordmaster, he would lead the Atreides military forces to Ix, just as he had commanded the strike against Baikal. In Leto's position, the head of House Atreides was required to avoid the actual fighting, though he wished he could be at the head of his troops. Instead, following Thufir's advice, Leto would act as the political spearhead on Kytane, where he would make the formal announcement explaining his actions. That is the job of a duke, the grizzled Mentat had insisted. Now Leto gazed up the steep roads that led to the top of the cliff. From this angle he could see the top levels of the castle. This is a good time for a major assault. While Baikal festers in that awful plague, Emperor Shaddam is distracted with his own schemes. We'll crush the Tleilaxu on Ix before he knows what we're doing. I've seen images of those jungles, Duncan said. No matter what excuses Shaddam makes, I don't doubt for a moment that he intended for it to happen. Leto nodded. Destroying Baikal's ecosystem goes far beyond any revenge I could have demanded for their crimes. Still, the situation on Baikal gives us another opportunity. He watched the first large fishing boats tie up to the docks. A rush of eager helpers swarmed forward to grab ropes and help steady the Grund nets. I provided generous medical aid to Richeese after my cousin attacked them. Now it is time to show the Landsrad that House Atreides can be benevolent to those who are not my relatives. He smiled. Thufir, before our primary forces depart secretly for Ix, I want you to gather a fleet of cargo ships. Accompany them with a military escort. I, Duke Leto Atreides, will send relief supplies to plague-ravaged Baikal and ask nothing in return. Duncan was appalled by the suggestion. But Leto, they tried to sell your ancestors to the Tleilaxu. And we need our house guard to stay here to defend Caladan while our forces strike Ix, Hawat added. This campaign has already depleted our resources. Send only a minimal military escort, Thufir, just enough to show that we're serious. As for the Baikalis, we've already punished them for their poor judgment at the Senesar War Memorial. We have nothing to gain by holding a grudge against an entire population. The Baikalis have seen how hard we can be. Now it is time to show them our benevolent side. My mother, who was not wrong all of the time, reminded me that a leader must show compassion as well as firmness. He pressed his lips together, remembering conversations he'd had with Romber about leadership, and how political considerations, though important, must be balanced with the needs of common citizens. Mark my words, Leto said. I do this for the people of Baikal, not for their politicians. This is not a reward for the actions of the Prime Magistrate, nor is it to be construed as forgiveness or even acceptance of an apology. Thufir Hawat frowned. Does this mean you do not wish me to accompany our troops to Ix, my Duke? Leto gave his old adviser a sly smile. I'll need your diplomatic skills at Baikal, Thufir. There will be tense moments when you reach the Imperial blockade. The planet is under strict quarantine, but I'm betting that the Emperor has not given explicit orders to destroy anyone who makes no attempt to land. Exploit that gray area. Both the Mentat and the Swordmaster looked at him as if he had gone insane. Leto continued. You're sure to draw the attention of the Sardaukar and maybe of Shaddam himself. In fact, it could be quite a spectacle. Beside him, Duncan brightened as he understood the real plan. Of course, a diversion. The Emperor can't fail to notice such a dramatic crisis. While Thufir faces down the Imperial blockade, no one will think of paying attention elsewhere. And it will draw all the Sardaukar there. We will have our forces in position on Ix before anyone can send word to Kytane. The Sardaukar on Ix will be operating without orders. The relief mission is just a diversion. Exactly. But one that could do some good for the people of Baikal, while increasing my standing in the Landsrat. After I throw Atreides' support to the military operation on Ix, I will require all the allies I can summon. On the crowded docks, huge cranes groaned as they hoisted bulging fish-filled nets out of holds. In the harbor beyond, trawlers lined up, awaiting their turn. The port facilities could not accommodate them all at once. When Duncan hurried up the hill to the barracks of the house guard, Leto remained behind to participate in the festival. Hawat insisted on staying with his duke as bodyguard. Load after load of swollen nets, crammed with millions of the silvery grund, were lifted to shore. The odor of fish filled the air. Muscular laborers hefted the squirming catch into vats and tubs filled with salt and water, while chefs used slotted shovels to scoop out the grund from the vats into steaming cauldrons of seasoned broth. Leto thrust his arms up to his elbows into one of the tubs, grabbing the little fish and passing them to the helpers down the conveyor line. Everyone cheered his contribution. He loved this part of his work. Thufir Hawat strolled stiffly through the dense crowds, constantly on the alert for any assassin who might be lurking among the fisherfolk. Leto, meanwhile, sat at an outdoor plank table to enjoy a savory meal of grund. The people applauded as he stuffed a handful into his mouth, and then they all joined in the feast. It was the last moment of peace he would experience for some time. Who knows what detritus of today will survive the eons of human history? It might be the slightest thing, a seemingly inconsequential item. Yet somehow it strikes a resonant chord and survives for thousands of years. Mother Superior, Rakela Berto Anirul, founder of the Bene Gesserit. Following a fitful night in her fourth set of unfamiliar apartments, Lady Anirul lurched out of bed and made it to the doorway. The voices followed her, like shadows in her skull. Even the ghost Lobia had joined the clamor, and she offered no assistance, no refuge. "What are you all trying to tell me?" The ever-vigilant medical sister Yosa approached, arms loose at her sides, body poised in a combat stance to prevent Anirul from passing her. "My lady, you must return to bed and get your rest." "There is no rest in there." Anirul wore a loose-fitting nightgown that clung to her perspiration-damp skin, and her copper-brown hair stuck out in all directions. Lines and shadows etched her features around bloodshot eyes. Previously, under Anirul's frenetic direction, servants had transferred her immense bed and heavy furnishings from one room to another, seeking a sufficiently quiet place. But nothing gave her relief. Yosa kept her voice calm. "All right, my lady, we will find some other place for you." Swaying as if on the verge of fainting, Anirul made a quick, aggressive move and shoved the medical sister off balance. The little woman stumbled over a table and sent an expensive, ornate vase crashing to the floor. Leaping past her, Anirul fled down the tiled hallway, knocking a breakfast tray out of a maidservant's hands. Running wildly, Anirul turned a corner, her bare feet slipping on the polished floor, and crashed into Mohiam, scattering a pile of loose papers and Redulian crystal sheets the truthsayer had been carrying. Reacting quickly, Mohiam abandoned her documents and gave chase, but lost ground. Within moments, a panting Yosa caught up with her. Ahead of them, wild-eyed Anirul opened the door to a service stairway. She surged through, but caught a foot on the hem of her sleeping gown. Crying out, she tumbled down the stairs. The pursuing Bene Gesserits arrived in a rush at the top of the stairs, just as Anirul, bruised and bleeding, struggled to sit up on the landing below. Mohiam hurried down and knelt beside the Emperor's wife. Under the guise of helping to steady her, the Reverend Mother gripped Anirul's arm and placed another hand around her waist. thus preventing her from escaping again. Yosa bent to study the injuries. Her breakdown has been a long time coming, and I fear it will only grow worse. The medical sister had already administered increasing doses of powerful psychotropic drugs in unsuccessful attempts to suppress the storms of other memory. Mohiam helped the injured sister to her feet. Anirul's gaze darted around in the shadowy stairwell as if she were a cornered animal. "The voices within cannot be silenced. They want me to join them." "Don't say that, my lady." Mohiam added a soothing form of voice, which seemed to have no effect on Anirul. The medical sister placed a quick-knit amplifier patch on Anirul's wounded forehead. Together they raised the Emperor's wife, slowly leading her back to her rooms. "I hear them clamoring in my head, but they utter only sentence fragments in a variety of languages, some familiar and some alien. I cannot understand what they are trying to tell me, why they are so alarmed." Anirul's voice throbbed with anguish. "Lobia is in there too, but even she cannot rise above the others and help me." The medical sister poured spiced tea from a ready pot on a credenza in the room. After she collapsed on an antique Raphaelian couch in her parlor, Anirul turned her hazel-eyed gaze to the dark figure of Mohiam. "Yosa, leave us. I need to speak with the Imperial Truthsayer. Alone." The medical sister became stern, but finally, grudgingly, she agreed to leave them alone. Lying on the sofa, Anirul inhaled a long, shuddering breath. "Secrets can be such a great burden." Studying her carefully, Mohiam took a sip of spiced tea and felt the melange flow smoothly into her awareness. "I have never thought of it that way, my lady. I consider it a great honor to be entrusted with important information." Lady Anirul took a sip of tepid tea and frowned, as if it contained a foul-tasting medicine. "Soon Jessica will give birth to a daughter who is destined to bear our long-awaited Kwisatz Haderach." "May we live to see that occur," Mohiam said, as if uttering a prayer. Now Anirul seemed entirely reasonable and conspiratorial. "But I have grave concerns as the Kwisatz mother. I alone see and remember all aspects of our breeding program. Why is other memory so disturbed? And why now, when we are so close to accomplishing our goal? Are they trying to warn us of some impending danger to Jessica's child? Is a disaster about to occur? Is the mother of the Kwisatz Haderach not going to be what we expect? Or is it something about the Kwisatz Haderach himself?" "Only 2 more weeks," Mohiam said. "Jessica is due to deliver soon." "I have decided that she must be told at least part of the truth, so that she can better protect herself and the child. Jessica must understand her destiny, and her importance to us all." Mohiam swallowed more tea while trying to cover her surprise at the suggestion. She felt a great affection for her secret daughter, who had also been her student for years on Wallach 9. Jessica's future, her destiny, was greater than either Mohiam's or Anirul's. "But to reveal so much, Lady Anirul? And you want me to tell her?" "You are her birth mother, after all." "Yes," Mohiam agreed, "the girl must be told at least a part of the truth." Even in her tormented state, Lady Anirul was right about that. "But Jessica does not need to know the identity of her father. That would be too cruel." There are obvious pressures of working in an environment where one isn't likely to survive even the smallest mistake. Count Hasimir Fenring, The Rewards of Risk, written in exile. During his trip back to Ix, leaving the Emperor to reap the political problems he had sown, Count Hasimir Fenring thought of subtle, malicious, and exceedingly painful deaths he would like to inflict upon Hydar Phenagitica for the treachery he had attempted with his face dancer. But none satisfied him. As he gave the appropriate hand signals to guards and descended to the grotto levels beneath the Ixion surface, he chided himself for not having seen the signs sooner and taking appropriate action against the turncoat Tleilaxu. The scheming master researcher had made too many excuses for a long time, and Emperor Shaddam had been completely duped. Amazingly, several Tleilaxu masters had recently appeared at court on Kaitain, as if they belonged there, and Shaddam tolerated it. But the Count knew the bitter truth. Despite more than 20 years of planning, research, and excessive funding, Project Amal was an utter failure. No matter what the Guild believed, Fenring was convinced the two navigators had failed because of the artificial spice, not some imagined Beakali plan. Foolishly, Shaddam had assumed that the synthetic spice was already in his grasp, and had acted accordingly. True, most of the evidence available to the Emperor pointed to long-awaited success, but Fenring remained uneasy. Despite the tissue-thin legal justifications, Shaddam's great spice war had greatly damaged his political relations with the noble houses. Now it would take decades to recover from all of the blunders, if they could recover at all. Perhaps it might be better if he and his lovely Margot took steps to protect themselves from the approaching storm, while leaving the Emperor to the wolves. Shaddam Corino would suffer for his own mistakes. Count Fenring did not need to sink into the depths with him. Now, in the doorway of his private administrative office, Hydar Phenagitica stood waiting for Fenring with pride and arrogance, as if his small body could not contain his high opinion of himself. Rust-brown smears marred the front of his white lab coat. At a sharp gesture from the master researcher, the Sardaukar guards slipped away, leaving him alone with Fenring in the office. Clenching and unclenching his fists, the Count forced control upon himself. He did not want to murder the little man too quickly. As he entered, Fenring made a point of closing the door behind them. Ajitika stepped forward, his rodent black eyes flashing with haughty self-importance. "Bow to me, Zoal!" He chattered additional commands in an incomprehensible guttural language, then switched to Imperial Galak. "You have sent no word and will be punished for your lapse." Fenring could barely stop himself from laughing at the man's assumption, but made a smirking little bow that seemed to mollify Ajitika. Then he lashed out and grasped the front of the master researcher's robes. "I am not your face dancer. I have already marked you for death. The question is how and when, Ajitika's grayish skin turned even paler as he realized his awful mistake. "Of course, my dear Count Fenring." His voice became raspy as the spice minister tightened his stranglehold.
You have passed my test. I am so pleased."
In disgust, Fenring flung him down. Arms and legs akimbo, Ajitika crashed hard onto the floor. Fenring wiped a hand on his own jerkin, feeling soiled after touching the treacherous creature. "It is time to salvage what we can from this disaster, Ajitika. Perhaps I should drop you from the balcony of the Grand Palais so that all the people can watch, In a strangled voice, the master researcher called for guards. Fenring heard footsteps come running, but he was not concerned. He was the Imperial Spice Minister and a close friend of Shaddam's. The Sardaukar would obey his orders. He smiled as an idea took shape in his mind. "Yes, I shall declare Ix free at last and become its great liberator. Along with the Sardaukar, I will decry the years of Tleilaxu oppression, destroy all evidence of your illegal Amal research, and then I, and Shaddam, of course, will emerge as heroes." The master researcher scrambled to his feet, looking like a cornered rat with very sharp teeth.
"You cannot do this, Count Fenring. We are so close now, so close. The Amal is ready."
"The Amal is a failure,"
Both Highlander tests were disasters, and you may be thankful that the Guild still hasn't figured out what we've done. Navigators can never use the synthetic spice. Who knows what other after-effects your substance will have? Nonsense! My Amal is perfect! Ajetica reached into the folds of his robe, as if for a hidden weapon. Fenring crouched to attack, but the scientist only brought out a rust-colored tablet, which he popped into his mouth. I have consumed extraordinary doses myself, and I feel magnificent! I am stronger than ever! I see the universe more clearly! He tapped his forehead so hard that it left a mark on the skin. The door burst open, and a squad of Sardaukar filed in, led by young Commander Kando Garon. The men moved with feral grace, less regimented than usual. I have triple spice rations for all the Sardaukar stationed here, Ajetica said. They have been consuming Amal for 6 months now. Their bodies are saturated with it. See how strong they look. Fenring studied the faces of the Imperial soldiers. He did see a wolfish intensity there, a hardness in their eyes, and a coiled danger that sang through their muscles. Garon bowed slightly to him, showing minimal deference. Maybe the Amal was too potent for those test navigators, and the mixture should have been adjusted, Ajitika continued. Or perhaps they should be trained differently. No need to dispose of all our progress because of some minor piloting error. We have invested too much. The Amal works. It works! Ajitika became feverish and fidgety, as if close to a seizure. With jittery, palsied movements, he scrambled past Fenring and elbowed the Sardaukar out of his way. Here, Count, you must see this. Let me convince you. The Emperor needs to consume some of my product himself. Yes, we must send samples back to Kaitane. He raised his hands as he strutted into the corridor, a little man with delusions of grandeur. You can't understand everything. Your mind is infinitely small. Fenring struggled to keep up as Ajitika scurried ahead. The soldiers followed silently. The main floor of the research pavilion always disgusted him, though the Count understood the necessity for the Tleilaxu axolotl tanks. Brain-dead females lay like cadavers, hooked up to bubbling life-support systems, no longer human, their bodies bloated and force-fed. Captive wombs, they were little more than biological factories that produced whatever organic substances or abominations the genetic wizards programmed into their reproductive systems. Curiously, the receptacles attached to their bodies, usually containing the Amal they had produced, were empty. Though still alive, the tanks seemed to be offline, all except for one. Ajitika led him to a naked young woman only recently hooked up to an axolotl system. She was androgynous and flat-chested, with short, dark hair. Her closed eyes had sunken into her face. Note this one, Count. Very healthy. Very fit.